for evidence and don't be satisfied until you know the why. It's not what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you do know that ain't so. Will Rogers, or Mark Twain, or someone else. How do you know? Becoming aware of the basis of your opinions or beliefs is an important step toward understanding yourself and your world better. Regularly consider your opinions, beliefs, and knowledge and subject them to the "How do I know?" test. What is the evidence that your understanding is based upon? Become aware of the sources of your opinions. If your sources are shaky, then you might want to be more open-minded to the possibility that your opinion or knowledge might be incorrect. Regularly find cases in which you need to rethink your views. Opening our minds to counterintuitive ideas can be the key to discovering novel solutions and building deeper understanding. But how can we take advantage of those opportunities? Certainly, we are not intentionally closed-minded. So how can we break free of our unintended closed-mindedness and see the world with less bias? First, we can simply try out alternative ideas hypothetically and temporarily. In other words, don't say, "Okay, I'll change my opinions on healthcare right now." Instead, say, "For the next day, or even the next 20 minutes, I'll pretend my opinions are the opposite of what I normally believe, even though I know it's nonsense, and see where those new beliefs take me." This strategy allows you to explore ideas without having to overcome deeply ingrained moral or institutional prejudices. Even following ideas that you know are wrong can be illuminating. Because in following the consequences of those wrong ideas, you might be led to better understand why your original belief is indeed correct, or you might be led to new and unexpected insights that run counter to your original beliefs. The 20th century physicist Niels Bohr used this process while trying to understand quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is a bizarre description of fundamental particles in physics. Its assertions about the nature of nature are strange and run counter to our intuition about the universe. So in trying to decide whether quantum mechanics might be a correct description of our physical world, Bohr instituted a practice at the Institute for Advanced Study of spending one day assuming that quantum mechanics was true and following the implications of that perspective, and then spending the next day assuming that quantum mechanics was false and following the consequences of that view. By alternating his views, he was able to explore each alternative more objectively. Incidentally, he eventually decided that quantum mechanics was a better description than the alternative theory of the day. A way to provoke effective thinking. Try on alternatives and size up the fit. Take some opinion that you hold that other people, those who clearly are wrong, do not hold. Every other hour, accept your own current opinion and think about its implications. And on the alternate hours, accept the alternative opinion and see where that leads. Try not to be judgmental. Don't resist the alternative views. You are not committing to any change. This exercise has the goal of understanding alternatives more realistically. As a result, you might change an opinion, but more likely you will simply have a better understanding of why the alternative views make sense to others. If an hour is too long a time period, try the challenge in 15-minute intervals. Illustration: sit next to the other side. Attend a meeting or dinner sponsored by a group that has a point of view different from your own. If you're a student and a Republican, attend a Young Democrats Club event. If you're an atheist, attend a Christian fellowship meeting. You might feel a bit uncomfortable at first, but avoid having your mind instantly think of refutations. Instead, listen and try to empathize and see a new point of view, and perhaps make a new connection. 4. See what's missing. Forcing yourself to see what's actually in front of you, rather than what you believe you should see, is a difficult task. However, an even greater challenge is to see what's missing. One of the most profound ways to see the world more clearly is to look deliberately for the gaps, the negative space, as it is called in the art world. That is, the space surrounding the objects or issues of interest. In our daily and intellectual experiences, there are gaps of many sorts. If you're studying some body of material, ask yourself to identify those concepts that you truly do not fully understand. Those concepts may, in fact, be from previous courses of study or ideas that you were supposed to have mastered in an earlier class or at an earlier point in your life. Don't despair. Honestly admitting those gaps in knowledge and understanding is the first important step in attempting to fill them. Of course, a harder question is, how can you see what's truly invisible? Add the adjective and uncover the gaps. Let's return to a time in which photographs were not in living color. During that period, people referred to pictures as photographs rather than black and white photographs as we do today. The possibility of color did not exist, so it was unnecessary to inject the adjective black and white. However, suppose we did include the phrase black and white before the existence of color photography. By highlighting that reality, we become conscious of current limitations and thus open our minds to new possibilities and potential opportunities. World War I was only given that name after we were deeply embattled in World War II. Before that horrific period of the 1940s, World War I was simply called the Great War, or even worse, the war to end all wars. What if we had called it World War I back in 1918? Such a moniker might have made the possibility of a second worldwide conflict a greater reality for governments and individuals, and perhaps led to better international policy decisions. We become conscious of issues when we explicitly identify and articulate them. In 1937, Sylvan Goldman, a small grocery store owner, wanted to better understand his shoppers. In describing the buying ability of a customer, he must have come up with something such as, "It is limited to what that person can carry." Armed with this insight and his desire to allow his customers to buy more, Mr. Goldman took some wooden folding chairs, affixed wheels to their legs, and a basket to their seats. Goldman invented the shopping cart. Not only did the cash start rolling in, but it also led the way for department, retail, electronic, and home improvement stores of the future to move lots and lots of merchandise. By just describing what was there, he was led to see the invisible. A way to provoke effective thinking. See the invisible. Select your own object, issue, or topic of study and attach an adjective or descriptive phrase, such as the first for the World War, that points out some reality of the situation, ideally some feature that is limiting or taken for granted. Then consider whether your phrase suggests new possibilities or opportunities. It might be helpful to consider this exercise as a word association game. For example, if you are a student, you could consider a word such as semester, and then list the first few adjectives that come to mind. For example, busy, boring, tiring, exciting, etc. Use your newfound adjectives to create interesting and provocative insights that otherwise might have gone unnoticed. Illustration and education. Caroline was contemplating the issues of education and decided to apply the include the adjective exercise. She quickly described the current educational system as non-individualized education. That designation immediately made her wonder about the extent to which education could, perhaps in the future, be tailored to individual differences in learning styles, in what each individual knows, in goals for education, and so forth. These thoughts were all inspired by just her description of how we teach today. 5. Final thoughts, deeper is better. Understand deeply is great advice, but what does it really mean? The truth is that most of us never understand anything deeply. After not doing well on a test, students often tell us, "I knew it, but I couldn't explain it." To which we respond, "If you can't explain it, you don't know it." Understanding simple things deeply means mastering the fundamental principles, ideas, and methods that then create a solid foundation on which you can build. Seeking the essential creates the core or skeleton that supports your understanding. Seeing what's actually there without prejudice lets you develop a less biased understanding of your world. And seeing what's missing helps you to identify the limits of your knowledge, to reveal new possibilities, and to create new solutions to complex problems. From the physical world to society, academics, personal relations, business, abstract ideas, and even sports, a deep examination of the simple and familiar is a potent first step for learning, thinking, creating, and problem solving. Perhaps the simplest metaphor for seeing the world more deeply is not metaphorical at all, but literally to look at the familiar world under magnification. When we focus a magnifying glass and then a microscope on ordinary objects, we suddenly see not only new worlds, but also explanations and organizing principles for our original macroscopic world. In fact, we associate understanding with the element Earth because when we attain a rich understanding, we are literally standing upon rock-solid, firm ground. Earth is that which is under where we stand. When you look at your familiar world with unaccustomed depth and clarity, your own world will open up to show richness, structure, and meaning that you never saw before. Among the goals of this audiobook are to describe how you can construct original ideas, how you can solve old problems, and how you can create new worlds. Here we are advocating a process that starts with your most comfortable surroundings, your most familiar territory, the basics that you know best, and encourages you to search deeply for features that you don't ordinarily perceive. This strategy opens your mind to success in everything from conquering calculus and producing provocative papers to everything beyond. What you know most about in this world are the familiar objects, actions, and ideas that make up the vast majority of your life experience. But what you don't do regularly is examine those common features of your life with a probing mind. You can intentionally look at familiar objects, actions, ideas, and experiences unusually deeply. And when you do, what world you will discover. The familiar is full of unseen depth and wonder. Clear away the distractions, see what's actually there, and make the invisible visible. Fire. 2. Igniting insights through mistakes. Fail to succeed. Success is the ability to go from one failure to another with no loss of enthusiasm. Winston Churchill. Back in the 1970s, three young guys, one being a college dropout, saw a chance to make it big. They put the rubber to the road and created a company that would efficiently analyze automobile traffic data collected from pneumatic road tube counters and gave their new venture the catchy company name Trafo Data. How could it fail? Although they produced some fine hardware and software, they ended up generating just a few $1,000s in revenue and quickly admitted defeat and closed the fledgling business. It was a failure. But through that failed enterprise, those techno geeks gained considerable and profound insights into computing machines and their true potential. Two of those founders took what they learned from their failed attempt and launched another startup company, this time with the catchy name Microsoft. Paul Allen and Bill Gates are poster boys for the power of exploiting failure and allowing mistakes to lead the way. Fail is not an obscene word. In our society, fail is viewed as another offensive four-letter word beginning with F. The typical attitude that mistakes should be avoided is patently wrong and has several detrimental consequences. The mindset that mistakes are poisonous often freezes us into inaction. If we have the healthier attitude that failure is a potent teacher and a scheduled stop along the road to success, then we find ourselves liberated to move forward sooner, because mistakes are actions we definitely can take at any time. If you're stuck, a mistake can be just the thing to unstick you. Any creative accomplishment evolves out of lessons learned from a long succession of missteps. Failure is a critical element of effective learning, teaching, and creative problem solving. Mistakes direct our attention in productive ways by forcing us to focus on the specific task of determining why the attempt at hand failed. Effective failure is an important, positive, and, as in the case of Microsoft, lucrative, step toward success. Viewing failure as an opportunity for learning requires a fresh mindset. If you think, "I'm stuck and giving up, I know I can't get it right," then get it wrong. Once you make the mistake, you can ask, "Why is that wrong?" Now you're back on track to figuring out the original challenge at hand. Students need to experience the arc of starting with failure and ending with success. Teachers need to embrace the power of failure by consciously inspiring students to learn the productive potential of making mistakes as important steps toward understanding. A way to provoke effective thinking. Fail 9 times. The next time you face a daunting challenge, think to yourself, "In order for me to resolve this issue, I will have to fail 9 times, but on the 10th attempt, I will be successful." This attitude frees you and allows you to think creatively without fear of failure, because you understand that learning from failure is a forward step toward success. Take a risk, and when you fail, no longer think, "Oh no, what a frustrating waste of time and effort." But instead, extract a new insight from that misstep and correctly think, "Great. One down, 9 to go. I'm making forward progress." And indeed you are. After your first failure, think, "Terrific, I'm 10% done." Mistakes, loss, and failure are all flashing lights clearly pointing the way to deeper understanding and creative solutions. Illustration, the author's response. We see ourselves as teachers of effective thinking. As such, we are so committed to failure that we assess and reward it. In our classes, 5% of our students' course grades are based on their quality of failure. You want an A in our classes? You had better fail and fail productively. That is, learn through those failed efforts. Every mistake is a teacher and holds a lesson. When you are working on problems that have not yet been solved, there are no guarantees about how soon you will find answers. The unknown solutions may be miles and years away, or you might be surprised to find them tomorrow, right around the corner. The moral of the story of this chapter is that mistakes are positive elements of quintessential thinking, and failure is an important part of the foundation upon which to build success. I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. I've lost almost 300 games. 26 times I've been trusted to take the game-winning shot and missed. I've failed over and over and over again in my life. And that is why I succeed. Michael Jordan. Once you're open to the positive potential of failure, failing productively involves two basic steps: creating the mistake and then exploiting the mistake. In this chapter, we encourage you to embrace several facets of failure that can lead to success. One method is to try your best to get it right and, if and when you fail, isolate the specific failed features of that attempt. Alternatively, deliberately try something that you know is wrong to identify and clarify specifically where the defects lie. Analyze each specific mistake to understand the reason it's wrong, thus gaining new insights and pointing you in the right direction. Finally, examine the mistakes to see if the failed attempt might be a correct solution to a different problem. 1. Welcome accidental missteps. Let your errors be your guide. A specific mistake is an excellent source of insight and direction because a mistake gives you something specific to think about. This attempt is wrong because blank. When you fill in the blank, you are forcing yourself to identify precisely what is wrong with your attempted solution. This process shifts the activity from trying to think of a correct solution, which you don't know at the moment, to the activity of correcting mistakes, which is often something you can do. Mary does mathematics. Mary was a first-year art and literature major in an honors program at the University of Texas. Much to her horror, the honors program had a mathematics requirement, and Mary was forced to enroll in a course appearing in the catalog as Modern Mathematics. She found herself in my, Starbird's, section of the class. Mary, along with many of her fellow students, was taking this class for one reason. She was forced to. She was truly excellent at many things, but she was not interested in math, and, in fact, she hated the subject. Not surprisingly, she was largely disengaged from the class discussions. She was going through the motions only to fulfill an unnecessary requirement, check it off her to-do list, and quickly move on. This attitude should never offend an instructor, because hopefully that instructor has his or her own goals for the class. In this case, not to create math converts, but instead for students to have an experience that could, in fact, transform their lives in a positive way, both in and beyond their formal education. This is Mary's story. One day, during a discussion about infinity, an abstract and counterintuitive subject that is challenging even for math majors, I posed a deep and subtle question. Given that math majors struggle with this issue, I knew that this question was beyond these students' reach. So I told the class that they would not be able to completely answer the question. Nevertheless, I wanted them to think about the issue as best they could. I instructed them to work in small groups to discuss the question and come up with some attempt at an answer. After about 3 minutes, I brought the small group discussions to a close and asked to hear their ideas. As a rule, instead of asking for volunteers, I cold call and pick my own volunteers, and on that day, I picked Mary. It was clear that Mary was uneasy to hear her name. When I asked her for her answer, she replied, "I don't want to say it because I know it's wrong." I, trying to be encouraging and supportive, agreed with her. "I'm sure it's wrong, but I still want to hear it." She then, reluctantly and with considerable annoyance, described her attempt. As she did, I wrote her solution on the blackboard. When she was through, I congratulated her. "You're right. Your solution is wrong." To which the entire class laughed and even Mary smiled momentarily. But I've already told you that no one would figure it out. Now, Mary, tell me just one thing that is wrong with your answer. Mary was able to quickly and clearly articulate something that was missing from her answer. I then prompted her by asking, Great! Now, how can you expand your incomplete solution to remove that specific defect you mentioned? In a perfect Jeopardy response, she asked, Couldn't we just... and offered a small modification of her original attempt that fixed the particular defect she had detected. Great! Now, Mary, is this solution correct? To which she quickly answered, No. Great! So, Mary, tell me just one thing that is wrong with your current answer. She did. Great! Now fix your incomplete solution to remove as many defects as you can find. Adapting the method that fixed the first defect, she quickly fixed several more and explained to the class her modified answer. Great! Now, Mary, is this solution correct? To which she triumphantly answered, Yes. But another student piped up and pointed out that there were still some omissions, to which Mary responded, Shoot, or words to that effect. I said, Okay, continue on. Find an error and fix it. After 5 iterations of this process of finding an error and fixing it, Mary realized that she was getting closer and closer to a complete, correct answer. For the 6th time, I asked, Is this solution correct? With great confidence and pride, Mary answered, Yes, it is. And it was correct. Moreover, the solution she discovered was creatively different from the standard answer found in math textbooks, including the textbook that we had authored. Mary created her own ideas to answer the question. My entire contribution was to ask her to make a guess, ask if that guess was correct, ask for a specific defect of the attempt, ask her to fix that particular flaw, and repeat the process. As class led out that day, Mary approached me and told me that after our little back-and-forth exercise, her mind was reeling. She had a paper due in her English class that she was stuck on. Now she knew exactly what to do. She would just sit down and write a really bad draft and then look for problems and fix them. There was a specific action she could definitely take. She could make a mistake. She felt liberated. Mary's story is thought-provoking. She had resolved a difficult issue that was, by all measures, well beyond her abilities. She used a technique of thinking that made her creative, effective, and successful. There is no vagueness or uncertainty about having solved this mathematical challenge. She definitely could not have done it without help. But the help was not mathematical. The help was entirely about how to engage her mind. And, of course, she could have used that exact same technique by simply giving herself the same prompts. Make an attempt, find a flaw, fix it, make an attempt. She could have been her own teacher. Furthermore, she can apply that technique to anything she wishes. Mary's story illustrates one specific, practical, broadly applicable strategy for effective thinking, learning, and creating. Successful students and famously successful people have used this strategy throughout history, and you can use it for your own benefit. Missteps in history. Why do speeches, music, art, architecture, software, books and plays all require first drafts? Because it's not until Shakespeare reads his bad first draft that he will discover what's really rotten in the state of Denmark. The defects as well as the strengths of our first effort aren't available for us to examine until they exist. Making the errors overt makes the corrections overt as well. Moreover, drafts often contain unexpected strong features. Iteration allows us to see what's there and how we can improve, a little bit at a time. On December 8, 1941, Franklin Delano Roosevelt delivered to Congress and the American people one of the most important speeches of his presidency. The first line of his oration was so powerful that many still remember his words. Yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. Those perfectly chosen words did not arrive all at once. They evolved from an earlier typed draft, a draft that FDR himself edited in his own hand. That earlier opening line read, Yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in world history, the United States of America was simultaneously and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan without warning. Great speeches only become great after they had the opportunity first to be, well, not so great. A man's errors are his portals of discovery. James Joyce. First drafts are not just for writers. Thomas Edison was famous for his incremental approach to intentional invention. Try something, see what's wrong, learn from the defect, try again. When he said that invention is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration, the perspiration was the process of incrementally making mistakes and learning from them to make the next attempts more apt to be closer to right. When Edison was asked how he felt about his countless failed attempts at making a light bulb, he replied, "I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work." Success is not about almost always succeeding. How would you feel if you were failing about 60% of the time? Sounds like a solid F. Well, in certain contexts, you'd be a superstar. A Major League Baseball player who fails 60% of the time, that is, who has a batting average of 400, would be phenomenal. No living player is that good. So in baseball, every player fails far more than half the time. In mathematical or scientific research, the batting averages are dramatically lower still. If scientists or mathematicians answer even one truly significant question in their whole life, they will be rightly regarded with great esteem. Success is about persisting through the process of repeatedly failing and learning from failure. The American Constitution has been a model for many governments around the world. But how many people remember that this was version 2.0 after the Founding Fathers' first attempted government, namely the Articles of Confederation, failed? The Articles of Confederation represented an attempt to organize the newly independent American states. When the Articles of Confederation were written, the authors did not view that attempt as a temporary measure until something better came along. The authors were striving for a long-term government. However, the defects of the Articles of Confederation provided valuable insights that led to the Constitution of the United States. And, of course, even our treasured Constitution has amendments, each correcting a defect or adding an improvement. Creating a solution and then identifying its limitations leads to further refined solutions. The way to get good ideas is to get lots of ideas and throw the bad ones away. Linus Pauling. You may not know how to do it right, but you can certainly do it wrong. A good way to generate useful mistakes is simply to tackle the issue at hand by quickly constructing the best solution you can with little or no effort. Like magic, suddenly many useful errors will appear out of thin air. Here's a practical means by which to create ideas. A way to provoke effective thinking. Don't stare at a blank screen. Take an issue or problem you are facing. For example, you may want to get organized or write a business plan or improve a course grade or write a paper or get more out of life. Open up a blank document on your computer. Now just quickly type any ideas, good, bad, inaccurate, or vague, that you have about the issue. Don't hesitate to record ideas or phrases that you know are not quite right. No one, except you, is going to read what you write. Your ideas will be very bad in many ways. They'll be disorganized and jumbled. They will be inaccurate or simply wrong. They'll be impractical. They will be boring. They won't come close to resolving the issue. They won't be creative. Congratulations. Excellent start. You may not feel that writing down bad ideas is a worthwhile start, but one thing is certain. Writing down bad ideas is something anyone can do. Anyone at any time can write a truly awful letter, report, essay, or story. Anyone can write down specific approaches to a problem that don't work. That is not a challenge, but it's also not the end of the story. Now read what you wrote and focus on two features, what's right and what's wrong. When you just write down ideas without worrying about correctness, structure, or elegance, your thoughts about the subject often flow out freely and clearly. The ideas that you are trying to express are in you, so when you write without fretting the mistakes, the surprising reality is that you will often say what you really want to say. You will include partial truths as well as some unexpected gems. Now you have something to do. You can tease out the good elements. You might find particularly nice phrases or pieces of strong ideas. You might uncover a word that is suggestive of some unstated interesting notion. You might find that you have clarified for yourself the core of the idea that you want to express. Looking for good features in your bad first attempt is a great first step towards some creative, high-quality work. Next, see if you can recognize and exploit what's wrong. When something is bad, it's often easy to see what's wrong and identify mistakes. Now you have something to do. Correct the errors you see. You are no longer staring at a blank computer screen hoping for perfection to magically materialize. You have created ideas and put them out where you can see them. You have traded in the impossible task of creating something that's perfect for the much easier task of mining gems and correcting errors. You are now doing something different. You are not creating a work on a blank canvas, but instead you are responding to a work already there. Your responses, in turn, will lead to new good ideas that you could not have created before you made the requisite mistakes. In making this action item practical, it is important to give yourself enough time for the required iterations. Thus, you must commit to starting your effort, that is, creating a crummy draft or first attempt, far enough in advance to allow the necessary gestation and iteration that leads to a polished work of which you will be proud. So start early. Illustration. This audiobook. You're listening to the result of many applications of this exercise. In my, Burgers, sophomore year at Connecticut College, I experienced a profound exercise in an introduction to philosophy class taught by Professor Rice. In the middle of the semester, Rice gave the instructions for the midterm paper. We were to write an essay not to exceed 5 pages with no other specific instructions except the title of the paper itself. Our title was to be My View of the World. This was a daunting but terrific exercise in taking all the great ancient philosophers we had studied thus far and filtering their ideas through our minds. Then, as the end of this term was looming, Professor Rice gave us the instructions for the final 10-page paper. Again, he simply gave us its title, My View of the World. That opportunity to revisit my own ideas from 2 months earlier and see how my mind had changed was a powerful exercise that remains with me as an important lesson. In fact, I incorporate this profound idea in my own classes on mathematics by asking students to regularly revisit concepts they previously considered. Create such opportunities for yourself, whether you're a student or not. Allow work to grow and evolve through iteratively identifying and improving on previous drafts and missteps. Give credit to failure. Instructors need to celebrate students' useful missteps, because those failed attempts lead to important epiphanies at the end. For example, if an instructor gives a cumulative final examination, then why not allow that grade to replace a midterm exam if the score on the final is higher? Why are we punishing students for their intermediate missteps that are, in fact, essential for the learning process? And why not embrace a similar mindset in the business world? If at first you do succeed, try again until you finally fail. In our own classes, we often intentionally solicit student mistakes. First, we ask our students to present their solutions to the entire class. If a student presents a correct solution, we will sometimes ask for another volunteer to present an erroneous solution to the same challenge, so the class can explore the reasons behind that defect. Understanding what doesn't work and why is valuable knowledge. This procedure validates the importance and positive value of making mistakes as a means of moving forward toward a deeper understanding of a body of knowledge. Students need to learn and grow from their intermediate failures. If a student does poorly on an assignment, then tossing it into the back of a notebook never to see the light of day again is foolish failure. This student has been given a great gift, the gift of being told what is wrong. Now it is the student's responsibility, if that individual is interested in truly succeeding, to make that wrong a right. How? By revisiting, right then and there, not the day before the test, those ideas that are not yet rock solid. Students often say, I got an 80% on this homework, that's good enough and I'm moving on. Bad idea. By not exploiting this great opportunity to learn from their mistakes, they're essentially throwing away, on average, 20% of their grade on the next exam before they've even taken it, and they're building future work on a cracked foundation. Why not learn from your current missteps today and give yourself a 20% bonus in your future? Mistakes present a great opportunity to learn and improve, but action is required. The wise instructor, or organizational leader, will clearly make it worthwhile for a student, or member of the group, right then and there, to learn from the mistakes. To make failure a positive step toward success, you need to revise your work, try again, try more, and seek help until you've completely understood the defects in your mistakes. Ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Try again, fail better. Samuel Beckett. 2. Finding the right question to the wrong answer. Sometimes when your attempt fails to resolve one issue, you might discover that you have actually found an imaginative answer to a totally different question. That is, your bad solution to one problem might lead to a totally different project altogether, a project suggested by the accidental virtues of your mostly bad attempt. Junk bonds. At 3M Research Laboratories, if someone says scotch, co-workers think transparent tape rather than adult beverage, and for good reason. 3M is one of the leading manufacturers of all that is sticky. In 1970, 3M scientist Spencer Silver was working hard to create an even stronger adhesive. His creation was a resounding failure. In fact, the bond was actually weaker than other 3M products of the day. It was so weak, it could be stuck to objects and then easily lifted off them without a trace. Oh well, Silver did not come unglued by his failed attempt, and 3M did not fire him. Wise move, since 4 years later, when 3M scientist Arthur Fry was trying to devise a way of placing bookmarks in his hymnal so they would neither fall out nor damage the pages, he recalled his colleague's weak mixture. Fry coated part of his bookmarks with Silver's super-weak adhesive and thus accidentally gave birth to one of 3M's most lucrative products, the Post-it note. It all arose out of a failed attempt. Seeing a mistake as possibly a correct answer to a different question puts our thinking on its head. We look at a mistake not as a wrong answer, but instead as an opportunity to ask, what is the question to which this is a correct answer? 2 reactions to mistakes. So when you see or make a mistake, you have at least 2 actions to take. 1, let the mistake lead you to a better attempt, and or 2, ask whether the mistake is a correct answer to a different question. A way to provoke effective thinking. Have a bad day. Bad days happen to good people. What separates the good from the great is how we react to that bad day. Bad days often include uncomfortably clear lessons about how to grow, learn, or reassess. So the next time you're having a bad day, make the conscious effort to find and extract positive lessons from those not-so-positive experiences. Illustration. Have a merry day. Was Mary's day in her math class a good day or a bad one? On first blush, it seemed not to be going well. The class was discussing infinity, which is scary enough, but then she was called out to share her thinking. That thinking was not perfect. However, by embracing her weaknesses as a way to reflect and learn, she grew. By the end of the class, Mary created something new and learned an important lesson about how to create ideas in the future. She had a bad day, and by taking advantage of it, made it a great one. 3. Failing by intent. Going to the extreme. Now we take the act of failing to its extreme. One profound way to make new discoveries is to intentionally fail along the way. Deliberately exaggerating or considering extreme, impractical scenarios often frees us to have an otherwise unforeseen insight. For example, manufacturers conduct stress tests to the point of breaking a product. Studying when and how the product fails provides valuable information into its relative strengths and weaknesses. Here is an example inspired by a middle school teacher. She was asked how she would teach some ideas of geometry if she had no constraints at all. That is, suppose she had unlimited resources and plenty of time and support. Her response was that she would take her entire class to the Eiffel Tower and measure its height using angles to illustrate the importance of similar triangles. Taking her class to Paris is totally ridiculous and out of the question. However, her solution, which she knew was impractical, actually leads directly to a very important epiphany. Namely, why not leave the classroom? Take the students outside so that they realize that mathematics is about the world around them. It is not just something you do inside the confines of the textbook. This important insight came from a solution that the teacher knew was impractical when she offered it. In business, you could ask what you would do if there were no budgetary constraints whatsoever. Maybe some aspects of those unrealistic solutions will point the way toward a practical solution that you otherwise would never have even considered. Have you ever tried to solve one of those challenging metal tavern puzzles in which you must get one piece disentangled from the rest of the puzzle? One effective method for making progress is to pretend the puzzle is completely elastic. Then you can usually imagine rather easily how to disentangle the pieces. But having learned the steps required to solve the rubber version of the puzzle, you can see what needs to be done with the rigid pieces to accomplish the same outcome. Solving the much easier but clearly unrealistic puzzle has transformed the difficult challenge into two conceptual steps: how to solve the easier rubber version of the puzzle, and then how to translate each of those steps to the unbending metal pieces. Some artistic movements, such as minimalism, were iconic examples of artists exaggerating a feature to extremes. Some viewers might look upon the results as mistakes, although the artists might view the results as plumbing the depths of artistic expression. Either way, exploring extremes is illuminating. An effective strategy for gaining insight is to exaggerate conditions either through a physical or thought experiment. A way to provoke effective thinking. Exaggerate to generate errors. Consider an issue or problem and now exaggerate some feature of it to a ridiculous extreme. For example, take a political, personal, business, academic, or other issue and create an extremely exaggerated perspective on the subject. If you are arguing one side of an issue, whether or not it is the side you truly believe, make the argument so exaggerated that you realize that it's way over the top. Now study your exaggerated description and discover some underlying defect. Does that defect persist in your original, non-exaggerated perspective? You might apply this exercise to such things as organizational structures or sports or any other activity or belief. Like a stress test, you might well apply this exercise to something that works well and learn how it breaks down. For example, large companies hire hackers to attempt to break into their computer systems to expose security weaknesses. Alternatively, try exaggerating a character, fictional or historical, or circumstance far beyond what you think a reader would tolerate. When you read it, you might discover that vast exaggeration is closer to what you want than you possibly would have guessed. But in any case, the exaggeration might give you a new insight into the role of the character or circumstance in your own mind. The strategy of exaggeration to extremes can be applied to any issue from writing to marketing to product development to politics. You might perform this exercise physically or metaphorically, depending on the issue. Illustrations. 1. In business. Jones & Sons lawn care business is failing due to the success of its main competitor, Green Thumb Cutters. The ridiculous extreme fantasy is to have the competition disappear. How can that silly fantasy help Jones & Sons? One way to make that green thumb go away is to acquire it and thus remove it as a competitor. Alternatively, one could make a competitor disappear by creating products or services that complement the other business. That is, rather than compete with the prosperous company, consider ways of sharing in its success. For example, Jones & Sons could lease and maintain lawnmowers for Green Thumb. 2. In school. Suppose a student's tendency is to cram and begin working on homework assignments at the last minute. An extreme stance would be to imagine starting assignments at the first minute, that is, at the moment it is assigned. While this proposal may not be practical, it does lead us to an important insight. When you complete an assignment impacts what you can gain from that exercise. A student gets more out of completing homework earlier than later, even if the time spent in each case is the same. Learning from others' missteps. Often we don't have to be the ones to actually make the mistake. We all know that some of our greatest lessons were learned from some of the worst people. When we see an evil or inept person in action, or we see a good or competent person make a huge blunder, we find it easy to recognize the pitfall and consciously turn that moment into a learning opportunity. 4. Final thoughts, a modified mindset. Mistakes and failure are not signs of weakness. Instead, they are opportunities for future success. Failure is a sign of a creative mind, of original thought and strength. In fact, at Williams College, one of the authors created a course entitled Exploring Creativity, in which students found themselves facing unfamiliar and uncomfortable intellectual challenges. To succeed in that course, students were required to push themselves hard to take risks and create wildly without fear of failure. A person who is willing to fail is someone who is willing to step outside the box. Being willing to fail is a liberating attribute of transformative thinking. Failing is progress. It's not losing ground. Often a mistake or the revelation of error is the most important step toward success. A colossal error may be just millimeters away from a great insight. When you're stuck and you don't know what to do, don't do nothing. Instead, fail. Making a specific mistake puts you in a different and better position than you were in before you started. And it's a forward step you know you can actually take. A ship in port is safe, but that's not what ships are built for. Admiral Grace Murray Hopper. Let's be honest. Failure can be frightening and uncomfortable, a true trial by fire. Thus, we associate the strategy of failing to succeed with the element fire. Problems that require truly creative solutions are problems that you simply do not know how to solve yet. This audiobook is all about being successful, even if, and often because, you fail first. Air. 3. Creating questions out of thin air. Be your own Socrates. The unexamined life is not worth living. Socrates. Many people view questions as irksome. They associate questions with being ignorant, being lost, or even worse, being tested. But here, we suggest a different perspective and show that questions can be an inspiring guide to insight and understanding. In fact, the very act of creating questions for yourself is a profound step toward understanding, even if the questions are neither asked nor answered. Socrates is perhaps the most famous philosopher in human history because of his method of generating ideas. He challenged his students, friends, and even enemies to make new discoveries by asking them uncomfortable, core questions. You would certainly be astonishingly successful if you had your very own personal Socrates with you at all times, prodding you with the right leading questions. In fact, such a 24/7 Socrates is possible, because you can generate your own questions that challenge your own assumptions and lead to insights. You can become your own Socrates. Wisdom just for the asking. Traditionally, people believe that it's in the answering of questions that progress is made. In fact, creating questions is as important, if not more important, than answering them, because framing good questions focuses your attention on the right issues. Remember how Mary, from the previous chapter, devised an original answer